Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'm excited to bring you today's webinar on the foundations of payment compliance. Payment compliance is a complicated web of requirements across a number of different laws, rules, and regulations. Understanding how these laws, rules, and regulations interact and conflict with one another is critical to operating a successful collection agency in today's environment. This webinar is being generously sponsored by PDC Flow. You'll get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I wanted to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, including the Daily Digest email newsletter and the Getting to Know weekly profile, as well as hosts webinars like this one and delivers information across a multitude of communication channels. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what the site has to offer. Let me tell you a little bit now about today's speakers. Crystal Collins started her career in the debt recovery business in 2005. After 3.5 years on the collection floor, she transferred to the trust department. She currently manages 3 employees and has trained each one for their specific tasks at Amqual Systems. Crystal is responsible for maintaining relationships with the company's third-party payment processing vendor and works closely with the IT department to obtain files from clients and is responsible for weekly, monthly payment reporting to all clients. Her department posts and deposits all funds received from patients, and she assists others at Amqual with new client implementation, ensuring that all processes are correct prior to loading new business. Michael Etman practices in the areas of collection, breach of contract, and defense of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and other consumer protection statutes. He has earned a reputation for his efficient methods and his ability to obtain high recovery rates, even in potentially volatile situations. He regularly represents creditors, including corporations and other general business entities, in contract compliance and commercial collection matters. Mike is a member of ACA International's Members Attorney Program. Scott Wortman from Blank Rome focuses his practice on consumer financial services litigation, including individual and class action defense, regulatory proceedings, and administrative investigations. Additionally, he represents and counsels clients on corporate and regulatory compliance procedures in a wide variety of consumer financial areas. Scott is also a strategic advisor to fintech and other digital business clients on privacy issues, data and cybersecurity, vendor management, and consumer protection. Allow me to thank Crystal, Michael, and Scott for participating in today's webinar. The format for today's webinar will be a discussion moderated by me. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. Also, a reminder that today's webinar is an audio-only event. There is no video component, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. A recording of the event will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. Finally, before we launch into the discussion, I need to read the following disclaimer. The information shared today is not intended to be legal advice and may not be used as legal advice. Every effort has been made to assure this information is up to date. It is not intended to be a full and exhaustive explanation of the law in any area, nor should it be used to replace the advice of your own legal counsel. Any opinions expressed are the opinions of the speaker and not his or her organization. And with that, let's begin today's discussion. Scott, I'm going to give you the first question. Let's set the table a little bit and talk about the basic laws and regulations that cover payment processing for companies in the ARM industry.
Thank you, Mike. And I think what you just said about not being full and exhaustive is exactly to segue into this conversation, because the list really is quite large as far as the laws and regulations that cover payment processing for companies in the accounts receivable management industry. And while each congressional term we see brings up proposals to standardizing laws, at the federal level, right now in the U.S., we currently don't have a single comprehensive federal law regulating privacy and the collection use processing disclosure and security regarding payment processing. Instead, we have a system of federal and state laws and regulations and common law principles that pretty much overlap dovetail and sometimes, unfortunately, contradict one another. We have also have government agencies that have developed guidelines and many industry groups that have undertaken self-regulatory efforts that don't have the force of law, but are considered best practices. We also have, as it stands, I haven't counted them, but it's quite immense, the number of privacy and data security laws governing payment processing on the state level. And sometimes the information at the state level is inconsistent state by state with scopes and obligations. So just to give a brief summary of some of the laws that are covered, and please feel free if anyone else wants to comment or to speak to any of them. But we all know we have the FDCPA, particularly when it comes to payment processing, convenience fees. We also have the laws regarding postdated checks. We also have rules regarding remotely created checks. The FCRA also with regards to payment processing, anything regarding accuracy and integrity. Even the Equal Credit Opportunity Act does play a role in payment processing. As you know, just to say it, a debt collector qualifies as a creditor where the debt collector participates in some aspect of the payment processing, and the ECOA can play a role. We also have the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which plays a role in payment processing. We have Dodd-Frank, which is enforced by the CFPB. We just recently, I think it was maybe a couple of years ago, the CFPB brought enforcement actions against three American Express companies for deceptive debt collection practices of their third-party debt collectors regarding payment processors. And it was all about debt collectors engaging in deceptive practices, again, alleged, falsely promising that American Express would report payments to the credit bureaus and improve the consumer's credit score, and issuing debt settlement offer letters that falsely claimed a waiver or forgiveness of remaining debt. And I think that case, if I'm not mistaken, settled for something along the lines of $10 million, if not more. There's also the red flag rules, the Consumer Fraud and Abuse Act, and like we said, many state card transaction laws.
Okay, well, that's a good starting point. Michael, is there anything else on top of that that you wanted to add as something that, you know, sort of sits at the core of payment processing compliance for the ARM industry?
Sure. Yes, thanks, Mike. I would also reference the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, otherwise Regulation E, especially as it pertains, of course, to doing any type of electronic transfers, obtaining authorization from a consumer, or really even as far as other laws that influence that or circle around it. It could even be the E-Sign Act and ways to obtain electronic authorization and such to process payments. So there, like Scott said, there's many guidelines out there as to, and we know the CFPB and other government agencies are looking at all of them when they perform audits or anything along those lines.
Excellent. So, Crystal, let me, as the collection agency representative on the panel, let me sort of take this question and sort of get your take on it. There's clearly a lot of different things that you need to be aware of and need to be compliant with. Can you maybe sort of talk a little bit about how your agency approaches this, you know, this area of compliance?
Sure. I think with what we do in the healthcare industry, a lot of it is, it's a general rule. You know, you always want to be accurate. You always want to be timely, things like that. But we also have a lot of client-specific items as well. What I'm familiar with here at our company is just standard operating procedures, making sure you have policies in place in order to make sure you properly dispose of your any type of confidential information, your payments and things like that.
Okay, great. So then we've talked a little bit about this this framework that exists. So Scott, let me go back to you and ask you, what advice do you give to your clients, or what advice would you give to a prospective client about how to build a strong foundation for a collection agency's payment processing compliance?
It's pretty extensive because it involves not only looking at the agency itself, but also the vendors that the agency's using, and also the agency is going to have to look at what their clients are looking for. And what we've learned and seen, I think, from both on the federal and state side, is that whether you're a collection agency or you're a bank, whatever it may be, you're going to be held accountable for the actions of your vendors as well. So certainly you want to adopt procedures for properly disposing of consumer information. I think you also want to look at and make certain that you're familiar with all of the state laws. I would say especially California, New Jersey, New York, where they've enacted laws requiring proper disposal of records containing personal information, dealing with payment processing. I think California, where it requires businesses to dispose of records containing personal information, again, with respect to payment processing, by shredding, erasing, or modifying the personal information so that the records make it unreadable. I think I would also advise or look into the possibility of encryption of transmitted records with respect to payment processing and files containing any of that personal information that's traveling across potentially public networks. And for files containing personal information on a system that's connected to the internet, I would want to make sure that they're reasonably up-to-date firewall protection and operating system security patches so that we can maintain the integrity of any of the personal information that goes back and forth, and I'm including credit card numbers with respect to payment processing. You would also want to look into various roles that training play, and also, again, speaking with the payment processors and figuring out from a vendor perspective what you would need.
I think Scott makes great points on that and brings up even a broader issue, of course, is it's certainly important to develop policies and procedures on this, but what we often see is, and what comes up through audits or even licensing reviews and such, is some type of compliance overview within the agency to make sure those policies and procedures are actually being followed. That tends to be where I see most of the problems come up, is not necessarily that an agency doesn't have policies and procedures. It's that there's no oversight or no review to actually ensure that they're being properly followed. Of course, until something wrong happens and then it comes up and it's determined, or until there's an audit, or I know they sometimes come up on licensing reviews where the agency or sometimes through a vendor has to provide 50 accounts under this bucket or 50 accounts under the other one, and they're reviewing for all of that information to see how certain accounts were handled and did they follow all of the, not just the state guidelines, but also their own policies and procedures. So certainly, yes, it's imperative to develop those policies and procedures, but it's equally important then to make sure they're actually being followed and have some type of oversight or random review, whichever it may be, especially when it deals with personal information.
Yeah, and I agree completely. From what I've seen, especially when I walk in to help a client prepare for an audit, or if I'm doing an audit on behalf of a creditor, it's the policies and procedures are usually very well written and articulated, but it comes down to implementation. And if you walk in and you're dealing again with payment processing, since that's the topic here, and there's a policy and procedure for data shredding, and you go to the you go to the agency and you realize that there's no data shredding bins, and that there's simply papers laying around with the non-public personally identifiable information contained on, let's say, the credit card information sheet or the EFT agreements, it's highly problematic. There's a difference between having a policy and actually implementing the policy.
Yeah, and I've seen it in situations where they'll leave information sitting on a desk with all of that, and really that could be and potentially is a violation to leave personally identifiable information sitting on an unattended desk or something where it's more, I wouldn't say public view, it's still internal, but still that's something that is part of a compliance that the audit would look out for is even just the casual placement of that information. It's really, I think what's becoming is we have an obligation to really safeguard that information at all times. And that's really the expectation that's put on us, unless it's being referred to at that moment or otherwise needed. It is that obligation that we have, or the agency has, to protect it and safeguard it to the best of our ability.
Yeah, and usually if I'm looking at a compliance management system, one of the things for payment processing that I try to assist clients with is, you know, looking at administrative safeguards, physical safeguards, and also technical safeguards. And one of the examples I like to give is a recent agreement between LifeLock Inc. and the Federal Trade Commission. They agreed to pay a $100 million penalty after the FTC alleged and had some significant proof that LifeLock failed to secure customers' personal data. And really what it came down to was a lack of shredding and a lack of having access control policies. And while, again, LifeLock is not a collection agency, the rules do apply, especially if you have certain creditors as clients, where they could potentially be held accountable, where you could potentially be held accountable, not only by your clients, not only by potentially a consumer, but also the regulators. And when the regulators come in, these are the types of violations that are, unfortunately, they're usually very easy to see because they're superficial. They're not technical in nature. They're tangible. They're concrete. And it's quite easy for a regulator to walk in and see what would potentially be negligent handling of payment processing.
Excellent. I just want to pause the discussion for a moment. Again, if you have a question, hit that Q&A button on your Zoom webinar control panel and type it in and shoot it over to us. I also wanted to just take a minute and at this point say a few words about the sponsor for today's webinar, PDC Flow. PDC Flow has been a leader in payment compliance within the accounts receivable industry for the past 14 years. With PDC Flow's full suite of payment management products, you can increase revenue while decreasing the man hours spent on processing the payments your business brings in. Accept credit card and ACH payments from customers through an online mobile optimized payment portal, IVR system, or cashier payment screen, or send a payment request straight to the customer or consumer through text or email instead of sending the consumer to make a payment. With their patent pending eSign Plus payments, an agency or accounts receivable department can obtain a wet signature on any payment to ensure Regulation E and NACHA compliance. One client of PDC Flow is manually setting up recurring schedules and sending authorizations through snail mail to meet Regulation E. They found that by using eSign Plus payments, they were able to automate notifications and receipts and save 14 man hours per week. On top of this, they were able to win 2 chargebacks in court with the e-signature audit report, keeping their merchant account open and in good standing. PDC Flow's payment management system keeps your business efficient, compliant, and profitable with one click. Again, thanks to Don, Hannah, and the team at PDC Flow for sponsoring today's webinar. So now let's pick up our discussion. Crystal, I want to circle back to what Michael and Scott were talking about, between maybe sort of the difference between having great policies and procedures and actually putting those into place. Can you talk a little bit about how you implement the policies and procedures at AIMCOL Systems to make sure they sort of match, you know, what's written?
Yeah, of course. We actually have secured offices for anybody that deals with any type of money, whether it's the accounting department or our payment processing department here, with limited access on who is able to come and go within our office. As Mike said about leaving, you know, going in and seeing papers and stuff over, across people's desks. We have a folder policy here. If you have something out that you're currently working on, you put it inside your folder, preferably inside your desk, but as long as it's in the secured office with only a few employees, it's okay just to leave it sitting, but it still needs to be either in the folder or turned over. We also have cameras as well that are reviewed sporadically to make sure that people are following the actual steps and procedures, putting stuff away, taking it where it needs to be, not leaving stuff sitting on the printer. I mean, there's numerous things I'm sure that I can't even think of right now, but that's just a couple off the top of my head.
Excellent. Scott, Michael, anything else that you would recommend a collection agency deploy to make sure that, you know, policies and procedures, especially as it pertains to payment processing, are being followed?
I think Crystal said it very well, and I think a lot of it comes down to properly training employees. And you want to make it fairly easy, I think, to enable, as far as payment processing, the consumer to specify the parameters of the payment. Just basic things like the time period for which the authorization is valid, the amount of the payments, the payee. You want to be able to also make it very easy to follow instructions for the agents for specifying the procedures a consumer has to follow to easily revoke authorization, training on dispute processing, and also you want to make sure the collectors or the agents that are handling the payment processing, that they have easy access to the policies and procedures. Usually it may be on a agency's intranet, which is preferable. That way, if they have any questions, they could look it up, and also access to supervisors. And the one thing that we always say is the simple advice is never under any circumstances write down, record, copy, or store any cardholder information anywhere. And that goes the same, I would say, for as Crystal brought up, for payment processing and mail opening, how really there needs to be robust policies and procedures that are secure when it comes to payment processing and mail opening, to make sure that it is in a secure environment and that there are various redundancies in place.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's what Crystal, she was getting to a good point. It's really just part of it is of course, just limiting the people to have access to that information. Obviously, the less people that would be required to retain or have that type of information, the you lessen your chance that there's going to be any type of problem that comes up. So it's easier to monitor fewer people, just the realities of it. So I think, yeah, that's a great, great system.
Excellent. So we've talked, Scott, you mentioned secure, and we talked a little bit about information security. Let's spend a couple more minutes on it. What role, you know, should information security play in a payment processing compliant payment processing platform?
Well, it's as far as information security, I think, you know, it's important to point out that both the FTC and the CFPB have taken the position in enforcement actions regarding payment processing that inadequate data security practices can form the basis for a deceptive practices claim. I think that's in and of itself enough for everyone in the industry to take notice. While the CFPB right now under Mulvaney certainly is a different dynamic than it was a few months ago, but we still have the FTC. There's still plenty of other regulators out there, and I'm still not convinced that we've seen the last of the CFPB as it relates to enforcing anything regarding payment processing and non-public personally identifiable information. So, and the other thing to note, I think, is that it, as I mentioned before, but it's fairly important, is that federal agencies and state agencies are taking the position that a financial institution may be held liable for third-party vendor conduct. So it's as far as information security, you also want to make sure that the payment processor is compliant. And part of that is making certain that the payment processor the company that's your vendor is not renting, selling, or otherwise disclosing the personal information to third parties. And it's difficult to really audit that and to know for certain, but you have to use best practices to try to make certain that you're dealing with a payment processor that can be trusted. You want to select service providers that are able to maintain appropriate safeguards. And you also want to contractually require service providers to maintain safeguards and oversee service their handling of customer information. I also do recommend, when possible, and it sometimes does require a letter from an attorney to the payment processor, not an angry or aggressive letter, but just a letter so that everyone's on the same page, so that they understand the importance of this, but that we are looking, when I'm representing an agency or someone using a payment processor, we are requesting submissions of independent data security program audits, and we do want to see implementation for mechanisms for quickly reversing transactions that may be deemed erroneous and unauthorized.
Excellent. Michael, let me come back to you. Looking at it from the lens of a collection agency, how should payment processing fit inside a compliance management system?
I mean, obviously it's going to be an imperative part. I mean, really, payments are what drives the entire business. So, that kind of goes without saying. So really, it's a question of whether, how does it fit inside the compliance management? I mean, I would say it really, at the end of the day, it is really the compliance management. I mean, aside from, of course, other federal and state regulations and such, but, It certainly has to be something that is taken seriously, that really this personal identifiable information is really not a joke at all. I mean, we know that in the last 5-10 years, with all of the different hacking or the Experian and some of the other the widely known issues that have come up. I think Target had it. I mean, we've heard of these big companies that have gotten hacked, that have had all these other issues going on. And so certainly, in the last 10 years, this has become a hot topic, not just of course in collections, but really across any type of financial or really business altogether. So, as to what how it really fits inside of compliance, I think everything has to drive towards that. It's like Scott mentioned, it's the FDCPA, it's the FCRA, it's other federal regulations. Everything is driving towards an end goal of not just data security, but in the payment processing, but just overall compliance. So I think the more any type of compliance manual or policies and procedures not just focuses on that, but just really as its driving force emphasizes that this really is the crux of our, well, at least in our industry here, it's really the crux of the entire industry and what we're trying to do. And as Scott just mentioned too, there's a lot of interaction with the vendors, with the payment processors themselves, the financial institution that have to make assurances that the vendors they're using are complying with all this. So I think right now, as to whether or not how the payment processing fits inside of it, I actually think there's a lot of interconnectivity between everything. All the accounts that we would get, that the vendors have, payment processors, we're all part of the same global function. And really only as strong as our weakest link overall. And that's where we're going to run into problems if somebody or some agency, some entity, whatever it is in that chain, fails, it could really impact everyone. And that's what Scott was mentioning, is the liability can be across the board. It doesn't have to be limited to just the entity that caused it or made a violation or allowed this information to get out. So really, I think that, yeah, that emphasis has to be on in any compliance management system that it's not just internal, it's also the external impact that it's going to have.
Good, thank you. Crystal, let me circle back to you. Put yourself in the shoes of a collection agency that is considering switching or looking for a new payment processing partner. What questions should a collection agency be asking of payment processors to ensure proper compliance? Can you give any examples?
Are they PCI compliant? Do the payment card industry data security standards stuff? What type of encryption do they use? There's a lot of stuff out there that you should be asking. And there's so many different services as well. What type of, how many merchants, it all ties together depending on your merchants that you have, how many merchants you need, how big are they globally, you know, the fees associated with the processing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and one other point, and Crystal, that's 100% right. There's so many different variables and so many things to account for. And one other question that I would typically ask is also, and does the payment processor have any subcontractors? Because if the payment processor is using subcontractors, that's something that the agency would need to know, especially from an audit standpoint.
All good information. Michael, let me come back to you. Let's spend a few minutes talking about Reg E. You mentioned it a couple of times, but really haven't delved in, and I know it's an important area. So I wanted to tee you up to talk to a little bit about Reg E as it pertains to accepting recurring payments.
Sure. No, and it's one of those topics you could probably spend a whole hour on, is just on Reg E and especially in recurring payments. So with Regulation E, the EFTA, there is a lot of debate that sometimes goes on as to what exactly it takes to comply. Now, there's been quite a bit of movement, of course, and I know the CFPB did their compliance bulletin, and so going on 2.5 years ago, November 2015, where they came out with a bunch of interpretations on Regulation E and pre-authorized transfers, things like that. So, but the industry has evolved since then, and so what we're really looking at is, well, what do you really need to set up for recurring payments or pre-authorized transfers? And really, the law itself hasn't changed that much. It just, you need an authorization from the consumer in order to set up recurring transfers. And then the authorization typically needs to be before the first transfer is processed. So, and now that all sounds well and good, except for it was a matter of how do you obtain that authorization and get that all approved, because there was this writing requirement as well too, that it wasn't just good enough to do it over a telephone call and get that, but you actually need to have some type of consent that you could demonstrate later on. So that's where these, I know there's a number of vendors now that are using either IVR systems or any type of digital system, anything that can be essentially reproduced, replicated, is accurate, anything along those lines to essentially back up this electronic record of the authorization. Because otherwise, the CFPB, what they had come out and said, and really through Regulation E, was you speak to a consumer over the telephone, you put an agreement into writing, you send two copies of it to the consumer and ask them to return one to you, a signed copy back to you, retaining one for themselves, and that you couldn't process anything until you get that signed copy back. And we know as a practical matter that that just is unlikely to happen, or at least not happen very quickly in this type of business. So what, of course, these other vendors and that focused on was how can we get around? How do we get that authentication without having to rely on mailing agreements back and forth? And so that's where they brought up the IVR, other types of recordings, those types of things that could be done digitally. I've seen some try to use it through email. And obviously, you start running into eSign Act and different things along those lines with confirming that the consumer receives emails, is able to ascertain and read disclosures and things along those lines, because Regulation E itself has a number of disclosures that have to be given and the way that the payments are set up. So I don't know how much we want to go into disclosures or what has to be in these payment letters or confirmation letters or anything like that, or if that's pretty widely based knowledge at this point, but I'm certainly happy to just go as little or as less as need be right now. So
I completely agree that there's a lot of contradictions out there regarding the Electronic Fund Transfer Act, and also we probably can't spend an entire day and do an 8-hour CLE where everyone will fall asleep talking about the act. But I do agree that there are some really awesome vendors out there that are using IVR in ways where they're, you know, taking apart the eSign Act, which allows a consumer to provide a signed written authorization electronically. And the IVRs, the ones that I've seen that have really worked well, are provide a mechanism for the consumer to punch in a code in order to demonstrate that they understand and that they're signing their name electronically. The email ones I'm not that familiar with, but the IVRs that have been done over the phone, I've seen a few that I've been comfortable with. And the other thing I think to point out is that, you know, there's a lot of question also. I get the question a lot of the time about the Electronic Fund Transfer Act. Is how do we apply it? Do we apply it differently to credit cards and debit cards? You know, because an account refers to a consumer's checking, savings, or other consumers' accounts, credit cards technically are not considered EFTs. Debit card transactions, on the other hand, are. But we do advise our clients to provide the notice to consumers who set up the recurring or post-dated credit card payments. For various reasons, we think it's good practice, and it also provides a safeguard for any misunderstanding by a regulator or a self-proclaimed consumer attorney. There's also the question about ACH, automated clearinghouse. So, you know, many types of ACH would be considered electronic fund transfers, EFTs, but this is another area where the courts really haven't resolved whether or not they should be treated as EFTs or not. You have cases that go both ways. So again, we do believe, and we're not giving legal advice here in this webinar, but we do believe that the cautious approach is treating the reoccurring ACH transactions as post-dated payment instructions and providing the consumers with the required notice.
Yeah, absolutely. Both, yeah, the required notices, and that's a good point. You have the required notices under Regulation E. You also have the required notices FDCPA if you're going to treat them as essentially post-dated checks. So you and of course, those don't even line up with each other necessarily, because one, it's just so. In short, I guess if I was going to summarize two things is the other option, of course, and they're not as widely used as they were before, but is creating the demand drafts, essentially using the information, creating a physical check, depositing that, and that, in theory, is outside of Regulation E as well. So because you're actually using a physical check. So there's still a lot of back and forth on really what exactly Regulation E will apply to, and then how you comply with it. But I'll summarize, I'll summarize what the basics of what needs to be in an authorization for a recurring payment. There's not a lot of debate on the basics of it, but really what it is if you're going to authorize it, whether it's IVR or sending a letter with the getting a copy back, it's you want to list the details of the recurring transaction, the timing of the payments, the start date, all of the amounts. If possible, the best ones are where they list the entire schedule of payments with the dates and amounts for everyone. You want to confirm the authorization by the consumer, including the date or how it was given, essentially something along the lines of, we discussed by telephone on such and such date that you're setting up this payment plan. Contain the name or identity of the consumer, and then the account, obviously would likely be redacted to some extent, but just the account or that identifying which one's going to be used for the transaction. So that's really just the basic of what a pre-authorized transfer acknowledgement or authorization needs to contain, and that can be done as it's being done now through the IVR systems, so long as it at least provides that basic information, and as long as it's reproducible, so that if there's ever any question, it can be not just authenticated but also reproduced. So that is really just a nutshell overview of EFTA and Regulation E as it applies to recurring transfers. The other disclosures that sometimes come up are dispute reporting, varying transfers, error resolution notices. You obviously have to tell the consumer about their right to stop payments and how to do so. So there are a few other disclosures that have to be given when you're setting those up. But again, they really can be done through an IVR system. So if it comes down, the takeaway, I suppose, is if an agency hasn't evaluated Regulation E or the EFTA yet, or really looked into their own procedures as it might apply, then I would certainly recommend that be done, because there are ways to comply with it now, and they're very efficient ways. So if you just haven't got to that step yet of actually making sure your methods comply with that, then that's what I would certainly recommend doing.
Excellent. Appreciate the deep dive. Crystal, let me circle back to you. Can you talk a little bit about how or whether AmCall takes recurring payments and what its processes are?
Sure. AmCall, we do actually take reoccurring payments. We can set them up however really the patient would like them to be set up. We actually use a third-party vendor, which does the encryption and everything for us. We just have processes. We have processes in order to capture them and run them in. That way, once the information is keyed, it disappears. The only thing that you can see is the transaction that will process in the future. No additional information besides that. We mail out monthly statements every month. We do the schedule thing at the beginning. I believe that's all on the back end. But I do know that we mail out reminder letters to the patients letting them know, hey, keep in mind this is going to draft, which I believe is part of the FDCPA rules. Pretty basic stuff here.
Okay. Excellent. Scott, wanted to circle back with you. There are a couple of questions that have come in while we were discussing Reg E, and wanted to just make sure that we hit the points that the people who ask questions are looking for. Again, if you have any questions, please enter them now. Question that came in, I think we've answered it, but just a simple thumbs up, thumbs down. What are the thoughts regarding whether a debt collector can accept recurring electronic funds transfers via telephone conversation, and if so, how best to assure compliance?
There are vendors out there that are implementing some really novel IVR solutions, and I would certainly give a shout out to some of the vendors that I know that are doing a great job. I just don't think this is the appropriate forum. But there are methods and manners to comply with the eSign Act and also the Electronic Fund Transfer Act through using IVR, especially where, again, it's very clear you have a recorded, everything is being recorded on the phone call, and you're providing a digital signature through a certain code that's set up so that the consumer is able to authorize their electronic signature consistent with the eSign Act.
Excellent. And Michael, I'll just reaffirm this with you, but the question is, are you aware of industry members that rely on recorded verbal consent as sufficient to meet the eSign requirements pursuant to the CFPB's 2015 compliance bulletin?
Solely based just on a recording, if I'm understanding that correctly, it would be my personal opinion that just a recording could be problematic. At a minimum, and even then, I don't know if it goes far enough, I would still be sending out a confirming letter with all of the details and the disclosures, the EFTA disclosures, and that would be at a minimum. But these IVR systems are designed to actually have input from a consumer by typing in, usually it's some code or something along those lines that not only confirms identity, but it also confirms their consent. So if the question is simply, am I aware if it's being done, I am sure it is being done. Do I think it necessarily complies with a strict interpretation of EFTA? Then my response to that would probably be no, unfortunately.
And Mike, I just want to concur with that. I do think you would need something, a written authorization. And that's, again, where the IVRs do come in. I don't think just having a telephone recording would be sufficient, in my humble opinion.
No problem. We've talked a little bit about the CFPB, and I just wanted to maybe cover it briefly before we get to the top of the hour and running out of time. Do you expect, Scott, and I'll ask you, do you expect to see anything from the CFPB in the way of changes to how it's interpreting or how it's regulating payment processing compliance?
I think that the CFPB, that just from a historical standpoint, we're still suffering, I think, the consequences as an industry from Operation Choke Point and also what the CFPB did. I guess there is a distinction between the Department of Justice's Operation Choke Point and how the CFPB piggybacked off that. But let's not forget that the CFPB did file a massive lawsuit against more than a dozen debt collectors and payment processors and related entities that the agency said failed to stop fraudulent collection tactics. And the groundbreaking part of the case is that the CFPB also sued several payment processors, including certain worldwide processors, because according to the CFPB, they said they should have known about alleged violations. What the alleged violations were, I couldn't tell you other than that they used their UDAP language and supposedly there was something deceptive, although to this date I can't tell you what the deceptive act from the collection agency actually was. But what this has led to is, and I still have clients to this day that call with issues with their banks, getting dropped by their banks because of Operation Choke Point. And if I'm not mistaken, the U.S. Department of Justice finally declared an end to Operation Choke Point, which was an initiative under President Obama that sought to eliminate legitimate access to the banking system by, let's say, debt collectors or other short-term lenders. And through it was really coordinated backroom dealings with the Department of Justice and also the FDIC and also the OCC. The Department of Justice, along with the CFPB, had a real chilling effect on the industry. So the move from the Department of Justice was long overdue, and it was followed, at least as far as I can recall, by a letter from, at that time, the acting controller of the currency, rejecting the tactics and goals of Operation Choke Points. So I'm hoping that that as far as oversight, sure, there should be oversight as far as the existing statutes are concerned, but not beyond what the statutes say, and not in a manner that's going to affect the industry adversely, especially through stigmatization.
Yeah, I agree. The CFPB, the examination manual for collection agencies, still has and contains, it's only about 2 pages, but it's a very small part on Regulation E, mostly focusing on how consent to process payments was provided. So whether or not the CFPB is going to focus on it, I think it always has to be a legitimate concern, simply because it's something that they have put under their purview. Whether we want to argue this or that, or what's a financial institution, or any of these other things, we know that it's something the CFPB has at least recognized, and if they choose to look into it further, they certainly can. So I think it will pretty much always be a legitimate concern, but I don't anticipate they're going to emphasize it any more than perhaps has already been done in previous years.
Excellent, thanks. We've talked a lot about the different regulations. Crystal, I wanted to ask you about training. How do you sort of go about training either new employees or even, you know, employees who've been working at the agency for a while on all of these different things? Is it just kind of in a classroom where you're just sort of sitting them down, walking them through it? Can you talk a little bit about how that might be done?
Yeah, the collectors on the floor usually go through our big training class in our department. Here, we actually do hands-on training, sitting with them, walking them through all the steps, making sure they're completing each actual step in saving the information, not payment information, of course, but other stuff, properly putting it in proper folders and stuff. Ours is just hands-on. It's really just talking to them, being real. And most people would, doing what we do, they understand the importance of, just if we called somewhere and wanted to pay a bill, they understand the importance of getting it done timely and correctly. Who wants to make 1,000 calls to get everything done? So it really helps when people understand the importance of what they're actually doing. We have a lot of procedures that are on everybody's desktops. That way they can go back and reference them later after your training is complete. We're very open if you have any questions. Concerns, don't just not ask. Definitely go ahead and speak up. It's better to ask now instead of later.
With regards to the hands-on training, can you talk a little bit about how much time is spent doing that?
It really varies person to person. Some people pick up the procedures really easy, and we do several different types. We have the mail processing. We have our online processing it all ties together, our electronic payments processing. We have the processing from the client that we have to do as well. And then we have our regular reporting that needs to be done. It's doing the steps over and over and over again. And it's just till it becomes repetitious. Some people are really, really good. And then other people just take a little bit more time. The people that I have currently now have been here, I say the most, it's probably like 5 years. So I haven't really had to train anybody in a while. She's probably been here 4 years. So I guess now I would be anxious to see how long it actually would take to walk somebody through the entire process and to see how long it took them to pick it up.
Excellent information. Thank you. A couple of more questions. You've only got a few minutes left that have come in. Can you touch on compliance regarding text messages or SMS messages sent to collect a card or ACH payment? Does anyone have any insight on that?
I know there have been vendors developing that technology to use text messaging for consent and such. I am not aware, unfortunately, of where that all ended up, and I've not done a thorough review of compliance standpoints. I mean, to some extent, I think you bring in TCPA issues with consent on that. It's likely there is a way to do it with the right consent, with the right authorization, verifying identities. But you're going to be crossing certainly between Regulation E, FDCPA, and TCPA across the board. But I know it is being worked on. But could I name any off the top of my head? The answer, I don't have it right off the top of my head. So.
No problem. Here's one more question. Any thoughts on faxed payments? Is it possible to accept them and remain in compliance?
Mike, I'm sorry. Can you ask the question again? And also, I apologize to everyone. I got kicked off for about 2 minutes. So if you were shouting my name into the ether, I unfortunately didn't hear you.
No, all good. Here's the question. Any thoughts on faxed payments by fax machine, I guess. Is it possible to accept them and remain in compliance?
Payment by fax.
Are you indicating like a credit card sent over and they want us to process it just faxed over?
Possibly. You know, that's the extent of the question I have. If the person who asks it wants to file, to submit more information, that's fine. But what I have right now is it's possible to accept fax payment. So I guess it's a check or maybe a credit card information sent via fax?
I would say no. I feel like there would be, maybe if it was signed, maybe if they sent over the credit card information along with their signature. Outside of that, without the signature, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing it.
Yeah, I guess we would need more information, Mike.
Okay.
With respect to if it's signed, what exactly is the authorization? What's on it? What does it say?
Right.
Got it. No problem. Well, we've reached the top of the hour. So if that person does have more information, feel free to email it to me, and I'll be happy to send it to the panel to get their insights and pass that back along. But I want to thank Crystal, Mike, and Scott for their insights and their time today. Definitely this webinar would not have been possible without their participation. I really appreciate them taking the time to lay out their insights, their perspectives, their strategies. Not everyone is willing to share as they are, so I think it's worth thanking them for that. We're taking time to thank them for that. I also want to thank PDC Flow for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.pdcflow.com to learn more about the company. Thank you to everybody who registered, participated, who asked questions today. Really appreciate you taking the time. Please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. And I hope everybody enjoys the rest of their day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.